Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Krupko, and I'll be going over five recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on. But either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top five countdown for the week. At number five, we have Japan's Marine Forces entering into service for the first time since World War II. Reuters reported last weekend that 1,500 troops of the Amphibious Rapid Deployment Brigade took part in a public ceremony on the southwestern Japanese coast of the East China Sea, commemorating the end of their training, with the editorial angle being that these forces might one day be used to protect the island nation from Japan. That's of course how Tokyo is tacitly portraying their role as it seeks to slowly do away with its post-World War II pacifist constitution and de facto transforming its so-called self-defense forces into a conventional military with the same rights as the rest of its global counterparts. This has expectedly prompted concerns that Japan might return to its historical militarism in fulfilling its lead-from-behind duties to contain China on the U.S.'s proxy behalf. But literally protecting one's homeland from any speculative threats doesn't actually endanger anyone, nor is it realistic to talk about a repeat of the 1930s invasion that Japan commenced against China over 8 decades ago either. Rather, the ARDB's real significance lays in its possibly eventual deployment abroad to ASEAN to protect joint Indo-Japanese-Asia-Africa growth corridor investments if Abe is successful in changing the constitution or engineers some quasi-constitutional workaround to allow that. Southeast Asia is an epicenter of Chinese One Belt, One Road projects, though the possible presence of Japanese troops in those countries wouldn't be aimed at disrupting Beijing's designs because they'd be there at the invitation of the host country, which certainly wouldn't want to shoot themselves in the knees by seeing that happen. Instead, their role would mostly be psychological in pressuring Chinese decision makers. There's already a weaponized infowar narrative being widely disseminated across the world that the Chinese might bully their Silk Road partners. So the American-backed Japanese objective is to turn the speculation into a fait accompli by getting Beijing to overreact to any possible future marine deployment in ASEAN predicated on supposedly protecting Tokyo's joint Indo-Japanese AAGC infrastructure investments, but actually functioning as an anti-Chinese PSYOP provocation. In any case, and regardless of how future scenarios unfold, the activation of Japan's Marine Force is proof that the post-World War II international order is changing, and that the world is entering an unprecedented era of uncertainty over what will eventually replace it. The next one up is Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orbán's Fidesz party winning a 2/3 supermajority in parliament. This stunning victory proves that the Soros-led anti-government campaign was woefully ineffective and may have actually been counterproductive by strengthening Orbán's appeal by reinforcing the country's developing siege mentality. Hungarians already feel under threat from the world at large ever since the migrant crisis. While they've come to view Brussels' hostility to their national sovereignty policies that they've implemented in response as a sign of regional aggression. The internal siege by pro-Western NGOs such as the Soros Foundation and others might have pushed some on-the-fence voters to side with Orbán out of fear that anything less than his party's decisive victory could endanger their national and cultural security. The end result is that Hungary has defended its reputation as a bastion of Eurorealism and made it impossible for the EU to sanction its ideological ally Poland because of the bloc's inability to reach the necessary unanimous decision in this regard, given that Orbán has remained in office and is firmly opposed to this. Therefore, the Polish-Hungarian Three Seas Axis will only tighten in the future and continue to expand its appeal in Central and Eastern Europe after proving that it's possible to stand up to the EU's liberal globalist elite and succeed, so long as leaders have the public's sincere support like Orbán does. He's been able to accomplish this through the ironically masterful employment of interwar Italian Marxist philosopher Antonio Gramsci's theory of cultural hegemony, which essentially asserts that cultural change must always precede profound political change in any society. The New York Times recently talked about how Orbán pulled this off in an article titled, How Viktor Orbán Bends Hungarian Society to His Will, which, despite its negative angle, makes for an instructive read if objectively assessed. The outlet describes how Orbán has inserted his Eurorealist ideology into civil society, the arts, grade school textbooks, universities, and the media in order to make Hungarian culture an instrument for advancing and sustaining his revolutionary ideal. It should be remembered that left-wing and violent organizations don't have a monopoly on revolutions, which can be generalized as just being the change from one organizational system to another. So it's entirely accurate to describe the Hungarian leader as a political and cultural revolutionary, or counter-revolutionary, depending on one's perspective, in liberating his society from Brussels' liberal, globalist yoke and returning it to its conservative, nationalist roots. Last weekend's election can therefore be interpreted as a popular referendum on the revolution, which Orbán won with flying colors, proving that the vast majority of people are firmly behind him every step of the way. Third in our countdown is U.S. Representative to the UN, Nikki Haley, undiplomatically threatening to slap Russia. She uttered her aggressive and disrespectful remarks while speaking at a university late last week, reinforcing the impression that she's cultivated over the past year of being an iconoclastic figure just like her boss, in challenging all existing conventions of her profession. Instead of speaking obliquely and implying asymmetrical responses to the differences that she has with her country's geopolitical rival like any other diplomat, especially a UN one, would ordinarily do, Haley decided to make a postmodern spectacle by personalizing the hitherto peaceful disagreements between the US and Russia in a condescending and mildly violent way. Instead of being ashamed of her rhetoric, Haley is visibly proud of it because she relishes in being the anti-diplomat and functioning as a Kraken-like systemic disruptor in shaking up the order of business at the UN. What she's doing is channeling Trump by returning to cruder but more direct forms of communication that don't adhere to the sociopolitical standards that have developed with time. And just like with the president, what you see is what you get when it comes to his UN envoy. There's no ambiguity over who the US's friends or foes are at any given moment, and all of its counterparts know that there will be consequences if they don't fall in line with Washington's new America First ideology, because the government has proven that it isn't shy about flexing its unipolar muscles in bullying and humiliating other countries in its quest to make America great again. Russia has refused to play second fiddle to the US, and that's why it's bearing the brunt of America's insults lately. In every which way possible, Haley is the female Trump and the embodiment of everything that he stands for. She's inexperienced, yet very confident, and her very presence on the international stage is designed to be as disruptive as possible in order to create new opportunities for the US to exert its influence amidst the calculated chaos that it causes. She's direct, assertive, and has a tendency to oversimplify complex developments by personalizing them through easy-to-understand but highly offensive examples that get the point across to her targeted audience. The more entrenched that a means of behavior is to the existing elite, the more that she endeavors to smash conventions through shocking stunts that capture widespread attention and lead to the conclusion that she's an agent of change, for better or for worse. Haley's latest disrespectful remarks about Russia are also a form of psychological warfare against the Kremlin, just like Trump's tweets are, in that they're trying to provoke a reciprocally iconoclastic response, whereby Moscow lowers itself to Washington's level and eschewing all standards of politeness to fight fire with fire. Doing so, however, will constitute a self-inflicted wound to the country's soft power, because Russian diplomats aren't professionally hardwired to behave that way, meaning that they'd uncomfortably be fighting on the Americans' turf and would always be at a disadvantage. That said, what Russia truly specializes in and which drives the US crazy is its snarky replies to Western ridiculousness, which has apparently gotten under America's skin and provoked Haley into her fit of rhetorical rage in threatening to slap Russia. Given that it might actually be Russia leading the US on the path of reputational self-destruction, and not the reverse, it'll be amusing to see how its diplomats respond to this, and whether they can infuriate her into making similar such statements that harm her country's international soft power standing. Our runner-up is the student-driven protests that have erupted in Bangladesh. The unrest broke out on Sunday after thousands of students staged sit-ins and other demonstrations in protest of the government's affirmative action policy to allocate 56% of civil society positions to the children of veterans from the 1971 war and what had been described as disadvantaged minority groups. The latter category is usually afforded certain privileges in many societies across the world, but the first mentioned one isn't, thus making it appear to some that the ruling Awami League is trying to create a privileged class of state beneficiaries as a vote bank for dividing and ruling the majority impoverished population. The students are concerned that they'll have difficulty finding respectable employment in the remaining 44% of the civil society positions available if the majority are already taken by potentially unqualified individuals who simply satisfy one politically defined criterion. The authorities' violent reaction to the students runs the risk of energizing the opposition Bangladesh Nationalist Party, that's been the Awami League's chief rival since independence, and whose leader was recently found guilty of corruption charges in what she claimed was a politically motivated show trial designed to prevent her from running in this December's election. BNP leader Khaleda Zia and Awami League head Sheikh Hasina have been competing with one another for decades already, and both have ruled the country at different times. But their personal feud has far-reaching international dimensions because of the differences in their foreign policies. The BNP is closer to Saudi Arabia and China, while the Awami League is known for its friendship with India, that some critics allege has become too close for comfort lately and threatening to turn the country into New Delhi's client state. In addition, the Awami League has been accused of creeping authoritarianism that some observers fear is radicalizing members of the opposition and making them susceptible to the type of extremist recruitment that could dangerously turn Bangladesh into Bangladesh. Khaleda Zia's imprisonment has prompted calls for the BNP to boycott the upcoming elections, just like they did last time around, and therefore deprive Sheikh Hasina's resultantly expected victory of any real legitimacy. So, before that happens, the state's violent response to the student unrest and the BNP's lack of participation in the polls will probably draw extra attention to the country's domestic situation. Any condemnation from leading international players might lead to the relative diplomatic isolation of the country and its further dependence on India, potentially turning fears about its junior status vis-a-vis this great power into a fait accompli. At our top spot, we've got the U.S.'s Department of Homeland Security setting up a media monitoring database. The Deep State agency put out an online bid for creating a system that will provide media comparison tools, design and rebranding tools, communication tools, and the ability to identify top media influencers in over 100 languages, and which will include a search feature for tracking online articles and social media conversations, engaging in real-time monitoring, analysis, and benchmarking media coverage, and carrying out analyses of content, volume, sentiment, geographical spread, influencers, language, and momentum of any given piece of online information. Furthermore, the DHS also hopes to build profiles on social media influencers, complete with their contact details, history of publications and partner sites, and an overview of their previous coverage. It should be assumed that the CIA has already been doing this for foreigners, but that the DHS's involvement in this dystopian scheme is the domestic continuation of this trend in enabling U.S.-directed deep state operatives to do what their internationally focused counterparts legally can't, which will expectedly see the CIA share in their collection, monitoring, processing, and dissemination experience with the DHS and other such agencies. The inevitable combination of the future domestic database with its presumably existing international counterpart will provide the U.S. with untold power in carrying out social engineering operations and influencing online debates through sock puppets and AI algorithms that learn exactly what to say in order to produce desired outcomes. Not only that, but this global database would also give the US deep state all the information it needs to know about which social media influencers to spy on in order to blackmail, discredit, or pay off if they're unable to effectively counter them through organized troll attacks, equipped in advance with weaponized narratives tailored written by computer programs to appeal to their targeted audience. Taking this proactive scenario even further, it's entirely possible that fake alt media sites might be set up with fake writers who are nothing more than American intelligence operatives or even just AI who have used the database's tools to learn what they need to say in order to be as convincing as possible to certain demographics. The continued development of advanced video software could even see fake, lifelike faces produced from scratch and made to become alt media superstars in the future, albeit ones who behave as the most effective controlled opposition imaginable in cleverly reinforcing pro-American narratives without being too obvious, relying as they would be on the insight attained from high-level AI analysis of the database tool. None of this is conspiratorial or over-the-top either, since that's exactly the direction that the world is moving in, and it'll soon become very difficult to discern real online commentators from AI bots if the said conveyors of information haven't appeared in person on a reputable alt-media outlet like RT. Alright folks, this wraps up this week's edition of Context Countdown, and as I always do, I want to warmly thank each and every one of you for tuning into my program. Hope you all have a nice weekend and tune in again next week. Thanks, bye.